so much for coming to our panel, Diversity in Publishing. I know it was a little bit of a difficulty finding this room. We made a lot of jokes about how it was annexed, and therefore this is the diversity panel, which is a funny joke, but not really. So I'm glad that we're all here to talk about it today. My name is Tricia Lowe. I'm the publicity manager at Small Press Distribution, which is, as you might know, the only not-for-profit literary distributor in the United States, and I'm very proud of it. I'm also myself actually a small publisher, like many of the staff members at SPD, which only goes to show sort of like how much we are a part of the community and we try to understand what the needs of publishers are. So yeah, I am sad to say that we had one panelist, Zoe Tuck, who tried to make it today, but she unfortunately had to cancel. We found a replacement, Duriel Harris, who then unfortunately had her flight canceled this morning. So it'll just be the three of us, but you know, I think that we should sort of keep the form of this panel pretty loose, and you know, I'll just introduce, this is Charles Flowers from Bloom, and this is Piali Bachara, who's the editor of Good Girls, Merry Doctors, out from Aunt Loop Books, which is one of the best-selling books at SPD this year. Yeah, we're really excited to be here, and we'll happy to take questions after the panel. Hopefully Piali will go first, and then Charles will go afterwards. We'll discuss a little bit. I'll have a few questions just amongst the three of us, and then we'll take questions from you. So I just wanted to say very quickly, as a matter of introduction, that you know, small press literature is really about representing underrepresented voices. That's a big part of what we do. It's not just about sort of like experimental or contemporary literature. It's really about trying to help broaden the audience to literature that represents different kinds of experiences. And we're very excited to speak more about that. But also to acknowledge that, you know, diversity is important in publishing, but obviously diversity in publishing as a problem is also a part of a larger structural issue, you know, structural racial issues in our society, especially in this current moment. So although this panel is specifically about diversity in publishing, I also want to make sure that we talk about other social justice issues that might impact the fact that there might be a problem with diversity in publishing, right?
It's might, all kind might of be?
Might be.
Yeah.
Definitely. I'm trying to be polite. But you know, I just wanted to acknowledge that. And also to of course acknowledge that, you know, part of diversity is making sure that people have access to all kinds of spaces and institutions. And of course AWP is not necessarily the most accessible conference, even though it is the largest writers conference in the United States. So just to acknowledge that fact while we're here. I'm just going to turn it over to Piali now. He's going to speak, and then Charles, and then we'll have a little discussion. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tricia. With the name of the title and with Tricia's really sort of lovely introduction, I was thinking a lot about what I wanted to say about diversity in publishing, and I thought that maybe the easiest thing to do would not be to sort of like prepare remarks, but to kind of talk to you guys about what my journey has been with publishing the anthology that came out last year. Part of the reason I want to do that is because I get a lot of questions now on how the book was published and sort of how it's been doing and how it has been doing what it's been doing. And so I thought I'd talk to you guys a little bit about that whole process for me, because it was a very long and very difficult process and I'll be a little less polite than Tricia here, because we have immense problems with diversity in publishing, right? I think one of the things that I wanted to start by saying is that I started my career in publishing. Because I'm from New York, I had the opportunity as a high schooler to intern at Warner Books, which is now, I believe, Grand Central Publishing. And I sort of really learned about the publishing industry in that moment. And to me at the time, it felt like publishing had this, the publishing world had this like sort of swanky New York glass office exterior. And even being in the interior of it, as at the time a 17-year-old brown woman, felt like I maybe wasn't supposed to be there. And I remember feeling like, okay, well, this is what working in the United States is going to be like. I'm just going to feel like I'm not supposed to be here. And that feeling continued for a really long time. And as I sort of moved through the stages of my career and I got my degrees and I was in journalism and I was in, I did a lot of other things sort of in the middle. And then I sort of came back to publishing and was in editorial at Yale University Press for several years. And even there, I ended up feeling, even though I was a good deal older, I still had the feeling that we have a problem with diversity in publishing, not only because, you know, there weren't that many projects that came through the press that were by people of color or even by women, but also because at the time that I was at the press, there were 87 employees. I was one of 3 employees of color. And this was, like, very recent, so it's not... I'm not that old, so it was pretty recent. And it really, that's not to call out a specific press, it's to call out the entire publishing universe and to say that, like, university presses and trade presses really have this issue. And sort of simultaneously, as I was sort of going through these sort of life and career experiences, I was also trying to put together this anthology, the full title of which is Good Girls Marry Doctors. The subtitle is South Asian American Daughters on Obedience and Rebellion. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a collection of brown women's nonfiction essays about their experiences growing up in and being parented in the United States and Canada. And I was, like, thinking about putting together this collection and trying to put together this collection even as I was working in these places. And the thing that became clear to me is not only that that pulling together the voices for such a collection was going to be a tremendous challenge, but that getting it published was going to be perhaps even a greater challenge. And I really felt like, well, at least I know this world. I work in publishing. At least this is something that I... you know, can do. I can sort of, like, gather these resources. And even then, it turned out, with all the privilege of, like, an education and a job in the sphere and all of that, it was still, like, remarkably impossible, really, to put this book together. I was told by many, many professionals in the industry that such a book could never be published because anthologies don't sell. And because anthologies by Asian American women will simply not be marketable or interesting to the American reader, and I was given the advice of having the anthology published in South Asia by a South Asian publisher, because of course it would not be interesting to an American audience, so maybe it might be interesting to a South Asian audience. And of course, the problem there is that this is not a book about South Asia. It is not even a book written by South Asians. It is a book written by Americans. It is a book written by women talking about being brown in America. And it needed to be published in the US. It needed to be read by Americans. And so going through that journey, the book took about a decade to put together and finally bring out. And a big part of the reason for that is because I kept being told by agents and editors and pretty much everybody you can think of, even like magazine editors, that that such a publication was simply not possible. And so I don't really know why I didn't listen to them. I think that there was a time in my life when, forget about editors, like, people who loved me were just like, please stop. Like, don't do this to yourself. And honey, it's not happening. Just stop. Like, and I think that the reason why I didn't is because I had read the essays that had come in. And the essays that had come in were so powerful and, like, heartbreaking and joyful and beautiful and diverse, not because they were written by South Asians, but diverse because they were written by such a huge array of people and such a huge array of women, and diverse from all kinds of different perspectives. And so I think that there was something in me that said, if I can just find a way to get these essays into the hands of readers, I feel like at least some people are going to feel about them the way I feel about them. And so, you know, I can tell you many long, boring stories about, like, the work involved, but really what I want to tell you is that it's really a process of just never, ever, ever, ever giving up on the project. And it's really, it's so exhausting. It's so devoid of money. It's so, it's so much. Like, an anthology particularly, because you're taking on the voices of other people, which is such a privilege and such an honor, and I am amazed that these women trusted me with their stories and sometimes with their secrets, and I'm stunned by that, and I'm so honored by it. But on the flip side of that, it also means that when you try to represent more than one voice, you get yelled at a lot, a lot, a lot, a lot, and you know, so it's not without its emotional burdens. To try and put together and put out a work like this. And I think that one of the reasons why I just sort of like kept going with it is because I just felt like the more people told me no, the more I felt like I had to prove yes, you know? And so after basically just pleading with many, many, many presses, one thing that really helped was getting the book a grant. I applied for a grant on behalf of the book. We ended up getting funding from the NEA, which was a really big deal. And it was really like, I mean, when that moment happened, when I got the NEA grant, it was really, that was the moment where I said, like, okay, like, there are readers here who believe in this work. I know that the no's that I'm getting are not about the work. They're about the assumption of what a book like this can do, right? And so, but when, you know, when I sent out parts of the work for these grant applications, I feel like people started to maybe see like what this work could be. And then of course, I ended up having a series of conversations with the editors at Antlit Books who, you know, as everybody was at first, were hesitant. And it was not an easy set of conversations even then. But the thing that I'll say about Aunt Lute and about like really small feminist presses particularly is that they are so much more willing to have that conversation, and I really appreciated that. So long, long, long story short, after many, many years of toil, I had this conversation with Aunt Lute Books. We got the grant, we pulled the essays together, we brought the book out. Hooray, the book came out in September of 2016, and that was so exciting, and I really thought that, like, I thought that was the accomplishment. I thought, oh my God, after like nearly 9 years, the book is in my hands, and that's so amazing. And then came the battle of publicity for the book, and that was a whole other thing, and honestly, it was harder. If anything, getting the book critical attention was maybe even harder than getting it published, because as we know, there are many books which get published and then kind of get forgotten about, and I didn't want this work to be that. And so when we talk about diversity in publishing, I think that I also want part of my presentation here to be about diversity in publicity. Thank you. You know, partially because I think that publicizing works like this is a huge part of publishing them, and I really found it to be so difficult to get the book the kind of attention that I wanted it to get. And again, there are no, like, you know, quick answers here. I hope. That the book has actually ended up getting a lot more attention than anybody ever thought it would. It's been selling a lot more than anybody ever thought it would. I get emails every day now about it, from women who are wanting to share their stories, and from women who are, you know, are moved by it, and sometimes just from people who felt like it was a piece of therapy for them, and that's amazing. But I think that the reason that that's happening is, once again, I had to put in the work. It is a tremendous amount of work. And the work was to email, phone call, tweet at, Facebook at, literally every single person I had ever met, ever, in every single sphere of publishing, ever. And to beg people to review the book for their publication, their magazines, their lit magazines, their newspapers, their, you know, whatever, to feature the book in some way, to feature an excerpt from the book, to you know, to interview me about the book, and the, you know, those interviews, those are time consuming too. You know, like you beg somebody to do an interview with you, they say yes, and then you have to do the interview. You know, like there's all of that, right? And then that's even aside from the events, and planning the events was a whole other thing. And we, in the last 6 months, I've been with the book in over 10 cities, and that again was just really me agitating in every single one of those places, begging every single space I'd ever been to that was a friendly space. In New York, it was the Asian American Writers Workshop. In Los Angeles, I asked the people who run Kaya Press to help me, you know, pull an event together. Like, you know, all of those things, just every space I could imagine, every person I could imagine, every publishing person that I had ever been in touch with or not been in touch with, I spent hours just on, like, looking up mastheads of magazines, trying to see if there might be a name that I might recognize, or trying to Facebook names that maybe I had common friends with, or, like, you know, just, like, I mean, this is the level of, like, you know, trying so hard to find names that might be amenable to helping put a spotlight on this work. And it was, I think it's really because of that, it was really just, like, 6 months of me sending out maybe 250 emails a day, asking and begging people to really to make this work known, putting together Facebook events pages for the events that we did have, making sure that those event pages were advertised at every local university, every local nonprofit, every, you know, all of these things, you know, it takes, you know, in some ways I'm now an extremely educated person about Asian American spaces and editors in the country. And that's, you know, that is wonderful knowledge to have. Of course, that knowledge keeps changing, but it is about putting in all of that work. And I'm not saying this to say, like, you know, well, we did the work and now the book is selling. Like, that, you know, I'm saying this because if you want to know about how to put a spotlight on a book that everybody has told you will not sell, cannot sell, cannot be published, nobody's interested, try again, try later, don't try ever, try in South Asia, you know, like, there's only one way to do it, and it's to absolutely kill yourself. I mean, I don't know what else to say, and the reason why I say that is because there is no help coming from the publishing industry to get our books out there or to get our books publicized when they are out there. And so if we are going to do it, it's entirely on us. And maybe that's something that we can have a conversation about today, about, you know, what we can do to make it a little less of a burden. Not just on the author. I think every author out there has to now be their own publicist a little bit, but to make it a little less of a burden on this community to have to do this in the face of being told, it ain't going to work, you know. So yeah, maybe we can think about that. Thank you.
That's amazing and infuriating, yeah, actually, because I started, my first publishing job was in 1987 at Scribner, and I was making $16,000 a year. Yes. And that, many things. I love when they say that they don't, it won't be marketable. That's, yes, because they don't know how to market it. Yeah. Doesn't mean every book can be marketed. It's, you have to know how to market. You, yeah, have to know the, yeah, audience. You have to know the community. You have, yeah, to know everything. So, I've heard that about gay books forever.
Yeah.
For a time. But I started in '87, and I was talking to one of my first bosses. She's here. She edits Bellevue Literary Review. Erica Goldman, and she reminded me that one of the big factors affecting the diversity, I mean, yes, there's individual bias of people, they don't like a kind of work, or they don't like a certain kind of people, those people exist, but class is a huge factor, because publishing has never paid well. So who goes into publishing? Upper middle class people, mostly white, in New York, some Jewish, obviously, but there's just a certain class of people who can afford to work in publishing. Either they're supported by their parents partly, they have five roommates, and that's amazing you had that internship, because there are some publishing programs to increase diversity, but they never address the economics of it, because publishing, like music, like most creative industries, they rely on a fresh crop of English majors every year. Mm-hmm. And they'll do anything to be near a book and to work, because I was one, to work with books. And so they can pay low wages, they burn out after 2 or 3 years, and you get another crop. And so the salaries are never commensurate to get sort of a diverse population applying. It's a privilege. I was middle class. I could afford to do it. I lived in Queens. My parents helped me pay my car insurance. You know, I had help. I had privilege, and I was able to stay there. Further in diversity, I came out and I worked for Anchor Books, which is an amazing publisher linked with Doubleday. They were known, this was early 90s, they were known for their African-American books, their Asian-American books. They published widely, and they were starting a gay line. I mean, they had gay books here and there, but they wanted to do a concentrated, we want to publish several, like a real list of gay books each year, not just one or two randomly. So I was brought on to do that, but then I was in this sort of ghetto of being the gay editor or being the gay books editor. So literary agents, which is another whole class structure thing and access and privilege, literary agents would only send me the gay projects, you know, but I needed to diversify my portfolio because then I was told I was doing too many gay books, so I needed to acquire African-American book or an Asian-American book. I had some Asian-American offers, so I was lucky I was able to work a little more broadly. But again, it was like, gay books don't sell. They don't, you know, after a certain while, there was this big boom, and then, oh, they don't sell. Or, you know, commercial publishing. And commercial publishing is so different from this beautiful world that we're in here. I mean, there are challenges in small press world and university press as well, but commercial publishing is so, so different. I remember hearing when Terry McMillan had her big first hit, Waiting to Excel, it's like, oh, black people read? I mean, literally, like, they didn't think there was an African-American market, despite decades of black bookstores and communities and wonderful black authors. It was like, oh, black women will buy books. And then Oprah happened. Hello. So publishing is really short-sighted and myopic sometimes. My experience with Bloom, it's a gay and lesbian literary journal. And I actually have an interesting story. I started it because there were like no gay literary journals at that time. There were like two for men. They always had naked men on the cover. It was semi-erotic. But I was working at the Academy of American Poets. I had an MFA. I was coming to AWP. I was like, I want a real literary journal. And it's not that these journals don't publish gay and lesbian writers, but there's something about a community, about having an identity-based sort of organization. Coffee Conum was starting around then, 1996, I think Coffee Conum started. Anyway, but sort of these Asian American Writers Workshop, some identity-based organizations were really starting. And so I banded together. I wanted to do something. I didn't want a naked man on the cover. And I got a distributor, Bookazine. I don't even know if they're still around. But the distributor, the guy who bought the gay books, he wasn't giving me any attention. You know, he wasn't paying attention to my emails and stuff. And so I went above him to a lesbian vice president, and she told him to pay attention, and so he paid attention. But we had this conversation, like, well, I just don't think it's going to sell. And I was like, why? He's like, well, it's a very plain cover. There's nothing sexy about the cover. And I was like, I think, let's try it. You know, I think there's a market for non-sexual covers. And eventually they were selling like 400 copies an issue. So it that I was true. I had a hunch. You had a vision of who needed this book, and I had a vision of who needed to be published and to hear this work. And you have to be really, your passion and your perseverance are like incredible. And that's what you need. That's actually what you need, because you will face resistance at almost every turn. If it's not getting an agent, if it's not getting a publisher. The production is probably the easiest part of it. Our technology has increased so much, and I started this before Facebook, you know, there was a time before Facebook, but the ways of sort of promoting and everything, it just, there's always going to be resistance, but there is, I think why we, I guess one of the questions of this panel or suggested to talk about, is it better? It's like, well, yes, it's better than 30 years ago.
Right.
But still, clearly, in the past 2 years, 3 years, there's still resistance. And how do we overcome that? How do we kind of systematically work on that? Because you can look at books being published, and there is a lot of diversity being published. But it's just as in women directors in Hollywood, like, who's behind the camera? You know, who's doing the editing, who's doing the designing, who's doing the selling? If I don't identify with something, how do I sell it? How do I market it? That's the whole thing, like, oh, you can't market it, it's unmarketable. It's like, no, you just haven't put the consciousness and the energy into figuring out how to reach it. Because we know, I mean, we're writers, we're creative. We know now, maybe we didn't know. I didn't know, you know, growing up, when I was figuring out I was gay, I didn't know there were other gay people. You know you have a difference somehow, and you don't know till later that there are others. So I know I'm not alone now. I knew, and publishing is pretty conducive to gays and lesbians and women, mostly. I mean, there's some very powerful women in commercial publishing. Mm-hmm. But you know you're not alone. If you have that vision, and you have that idea, and you're coming from a community that's not being heard, or not being marketed to, I don't know. You can do it. I mean, it's not impossible. Clearly, your book is selling. I think the role of a distributor is immense.
It's huge.
I can print a book tomorrow, but then I have 1,000 copies of a book sitting there, and how do I get them into the hands of people? So distribution is a huge part of it. I'm curious about the publicity side, because my hunch, my sense is that with social media and Facebook, that would be easier somehow. But it also, book review coverage is very small in newspapers or magazines. You know, I think I have a friend who works on O Magazine. He's one of the book people there. And, you know, they have 8 pages in the summer issue to fill. You know, it's like 8 pages. Whoa, how many books are going to get in 8 pages? You know, it's like, and that's Oprah. You know, she loves books. So I'm sad to hear that it's harder to get attention. Because you would think with podcasts and, I don't know, all kinds of new media outlets, there's so many ways to reach people now. People can be connected more quickly.
But you really have to make yourself a psychotic nuisance to be heard.
Right, exactly. Because, that's the thing. There's more things being published all the time, but how do you get someone's attention? How do you get that reader's attention? You know, and how does radio is great, but not a lot of people get on radio either, you know. And it's weird. I think there's some structural issues around the economics of it that really affect the diversity. And then there is the own personal bias of people who, they're not interested in lesbian fiction, you know. Why would I read that, someone might say. Because a friend of mine is like, you know, because of success of Toni Morrison and Terry McMillan and other people, there is a kind of, I think there's a liberal sense that I need to read diversely to be a better person. But that hasn't necessarily extended to LGBT.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has recently, maybe with marriage equality, but people aren't like, oh, I want to read this new gay novel. People just don't say that. Straight people don't sound so don't say that usually, unless it's, I don't know, guess lesbian. I don't know. So I don't know. It's challenging, but I've been doing it 30 years.
Which is amazing.
Which is
amazing.
Scary. Yeah. I was just adding that up. I was like, oh my God. But yeah, $16,000. And then I worked for 2 years. I went to get my MFA in poetry. I came back 2 years later. So this is now 1991. And I was making $20,000. And I was thrilled. But that's, you know.
Those are the numbers, though.
Those are the numbers. I mean, I'm sure it's not much higher now, even though New York is crazy. I think we're really blessed with all the small presses that are here and the journals. And yes, some of them have been around for decades and maybe they're stodgy and kind of white. But it seems like the younger generations are much more inclusive. That's my perception. I don't know. I'm an old white guy. I don't know. That it seems more diverse. And what's being published, and the people staffing the tables, but I don't know. The questions? People have questions, or do you have questions?
I have questions. Sorry, if that's okay.
I'm not moderating. Sorry, I like to do that. Sorry.
No, it's funny. I mean, I have lots of questions. After, thank you so much for you know, narrating your accounts. I mean, I think those experiences are very valuable. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm sort of, it's funny. I'm reminded of this thing that happened. Do you guys know about the Left Right Conference? It was kind of like a radical poetry conference in the mm-hmm. 70s. And it was meant to sort of like bring together all kinds of different identitarian groups of writers. So, you know, feminists, gay and lesbian poets, people of color. And there was an older white poet who said, oh, thank you for coming to all the identitarian groups. And, you know, it's really amazing. He said in this condescending way, sort of like that, you know, you guys are still interested in writing in spite of all the difficulties that you've experienced. And, One of the women poets came right back at him and said, you know, actually, we write and make the work that we do because of all the difficulties that we have experienced. And I think that, you know, that's something that is important to keep in mind, sort of, as we speak about diversity or as we speak about writing sort of stories and narratives, that it really is, you know, it's not in spite of, but because of. And mm-hmm. it's about sharing those stories and sort of like sharing experiences in community that is so important. Mm-hmm. I guess my first question would be, you know, there's a lot of, I think that, you know, you're right, Charles, in terms of people nowadays really wanting for publications and for, you know, literary magazines and such, events to be mm-hmm. diverse. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that people want to make an
AWP
effort.
AWP has changed. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot.
People really want to make an effort because to do pressure. That. And it's very well-intentioned. Yeah. However, you know, As someone who's Asian American, as someone who knows a lot of, you know, different writers, there's also like a sort of sense that tokenization might mm-hmm. be happening, mm-hmm. and that's kind of something that I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. The sort of idea that, you know, if you want to be diverse as a press, you just got to find that one African American author. Mm. It doesn't matter who it is, you know, or, mm-hmm. you know, there's a sense that like, you know, there's one Asian American author who's really popular right now, so everybody in a reading series is going to ask them to read, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how that sort of like plays into considerations people are making in terms of like diversity or, you know, what people mm-hmm. can sort of do better in terms of thinking around mm-hmm. diversity and tokenism. Yeah, just happy to hear your ideas about that.
Well, one of the things that I am thinking about as you say this is the fact that like, because of this emphasis on diversity, which I'm thrilled about and which I do think has made a difference, I really do. But I do think that it has also brought about this kind of hierarchy of diverseness, which, you know, I can't necessarily speak too much to it, but I can certainly speak to being a brown Asian American woman, which has been made very clear to me is on the lower side of the totem pole of diversity. So because Asian America is seen as being a model minority, and because Asian Americans are read as socioeconomically similar to white America, writing from that standpoint is usually seen in the market as being not their star prize diverse book. It's diverse. I mean, you know, they're brown, but like, but you know, they're you know, there's a lot of them came from somewhat privileged families. A lot of them, you know, are probably straight, you know. So, you know, on the rating of like how diverse you can be, how, you know, that's, you're not very high on the poll. That's kind of the reaction that I've got from quite a few people. And so while I think that, you know, having this emphasis on diversity is so important, I do think that we are still in the murky waters of figuring out what that means, mm-hmm. And what we mean when we say the word diversity, and sort of who we are talking about when we are talking about a diverse array of opinions and voices.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's true, because publishing, especially commercial publishing, they chase the trend. If there's a bestseller by a certain type of person, Terry McMillan, then every publisher wants a Terry McMillan. So they'll go for, or this is what happened in the 90s, I should say. And so everyone needs to have their black woman mainstream mm-hmm. author. And so they chase trends, and that can lead definitely to, like, let's get our Terry McMillan, mm-hmm. and that's all they're looking for. And so if you're an African-American woman who writes differently, a different kind of story, say Claudia Rankine, mm-hmm. you may not be read as well or mm-hmm. as openly as, because they don't think, because you're a difficult writer, you write about difficult issues, I don't know how to market a difficult issue, I'm going to stick to the, you know, light romance or something like that. So there's those conscious kind of decisions being made, at least at the commercial side. And I think it's also, what was the thing I was saying? I know one of the things that motivated me to do Bloom was there were very few publications, and the men and the women were separate. There was nothing that published lesbians and gays together. And my first poetry editor was Joan Larkin. Feminist. I was like, so from the very beginning, it was equally gendered. And this was before Vita, and we need organizations like Vita who yeah. do the counts and say, like, mm-hmm. you have 5 women and 95 men. What's that about? You know, we need those kind of consciousness raising things. But we consciously said, okay, we have 10 women poets and no poets, you know, mm-hmm. or three pieces of fiction by women, and, you know, and wide range. We were very conscious about that, but we made a conscious, determined effort to find people. Because another publication at the time was like, oh, we just can't find lesbian poetry. I'm like, hello, just put out a call and it'll come. But you really have to have the willingness
yeah.
and the consciousness
yeah.
to pursue it. And if you're truly going to be, I mean, ideally you think a publisher will be like, I want the best story. Mm-hmm. I want to hear a story I haven't heard, or I want to hear a story I know but told in a different way, mm-hmm. and to read widely, mm-hmm. to find those different kinds of tellings.
Right.
But you really have to want it as much as she wanted to get published, as much as I wanted to put something out there for men and women, and to make it beautiful and whatever. And now this was my last issue. I finished this summer. I've done 10 issues, but I say, like, the whole landscape has changed. There's like a dozen LGBT publications mm-hmm. I can point to now that wasn't there, you know, because for 10 years I've been saying, you can do it. If you want to do it, you can do it. You can make it happen, you know. And but the whole tokenism, I don't know.
And that is not to say, I just want to add to that, that is not to say that there shouldn't be an acknowledgement. There absolutely should be, and there ought to be an acknowledgement of the fact that, like, there are certain ethnicities, at certain socioeconomic backgrounds, at certain kinds of stories
mm-hmm. right.
from certain kinds of people that have borne a lot more than other background people of other backgrounds
mm-hmm.
have.
Mm-hmm.
That is completely true, and we need to be very aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be, like, I'm not just saying that, like, in this sort of, like, you know, sort of muddy world of diversity, like, any kind of diversity counts as, you know, like,
right.
it's not that. I think we really need to be paying attention to the specific histories of our country and to the specific sort of legacies that those histories have borne, and that
mm.
that is very important. But I do think we need to be conscious about
mm.
all of it.
Right. I mean, it really strikes me that, you know, like,
sorry, like Tress is saying, you know, the amazing thing about small press literature is that there are multiple literary magazines and sort of like anthologies that are being represented at this small press fair that are actually, you know, small press culture has allowed sort of like people who are underrepresented to sort of represent themselves, right, in a fashion that feels good to them. And part of the work of being diverse is really just about, like Charles says, reading, right? It's about something that we all are supposed to love and want to do anyway. And I think that that sort of like being willing to do the reading rather than sort of like go on someone's sort of identity is already the first step in making in really understanding what diversity is, right? Because, you know, in reading you might discover that someone who's African American's story is very different than someone else's story who's also African American, right, because of things like background and class. And so, you know, diversity doesn't necessarily mean sort of like representing every identity category in the sort of like identity rainbow of today. It's really just sort of like taking stories for what they are and, like you say, paying attention to the specific histories of each ethnicity and sort of like especially the history of this country and stuff like that. So I have one more question and then I guess we can open it up to the audience. But you know, there's been a lot of talk recently about sort of like in this political moment, what can art do, right? Like, you know, I think that it's nice to sort of think that you know, publishing a poem can sort of make a difference in the world, and in some ways it can, but it's also not the same as sort of like calling your congressman or like, you know, going to the march or whatever. So I'm just wondering if you guys have any thoughts about, you know, that relationship about sort of like publishing and how it relates to this particular moment and, you know, what's important about it or what it kind of lacks actually as an action, or, you know? Just curious.
Okay. Well, I actually work for an arts advocacy organization called Arts for LA. We're like Americans for the Arts, but we're LA County. So we teach people how to be arts advocates. And we've really been, but we call our congressmen and our city council members and we survey candidates for political office. But LA has been sort of, you know, California is this sort of golden state, literally, where very liberal, we're not gonna cooperate with immigration shit, and you know, we're going to be our sanctuary cities and all this stuff, but what is, people are still just like floundering. They don't know where to land because they want to take action, but they're artists as well. So how can my art inform what I'm doing? I was just at a panel called the Elegy Endures, and it was about 30 years of writing about HIV and AIDS, and it marks the AIDS quilt debuted 30 years ago here in D.C. But it talked to someone, they were quoting this African-American writer, Melvin Dixon, who in a 1992 speech talked about, we are responsible for the preservation and the celebration of our literature. Like, we are the ones who have to do that work. We can't rely upon other people necessarily do it, other communities. And this is at a time when the president wasn't even saying the word AIDS and the FDA wasn't approving anything and all of that stuff. But it's like, but the writing, words are our weapon. Words are our social tool or activism tool. I think the biggest thing that art can do, and not all art, because they have different purposes, but it's the, especially I think words, reading, literature, is a creation of empathy. Because if you can identify with someone who has completely different facts than you, but you identify with them what they've gone through or emotionally or something, then that might tip, might open the door a little bit toward acceptance or equality. So I think the creation of empathy and the stories we tell, we cannot stop telling our stories. That's like the first line. For the NEA in particular, the NEA, the coming fight around that is telling the stories of the impact of the NEA. How that grant
changed my life.
That's amazing. Yeah. But the NEA funds every congressional district. Every congressperson can say, I get a little cut of NEA. So part of the national campaign is to get people to tell their congressmen the impact of the NEA in their lives, whether it funded a book, whether it funded a program, a museum, or something like that. So it's telling those stories to give them, I hate using military metaphor, but ammunition for the coming fight, and say, I'm going to defend the NEA because it's impacting this many people this way in my district. And so it's the storytelling. It's having the, so I think you can wed your at least literary talents with activism in a way. It's not for everyone. Other people want to march in the streets. I haven't marched yet. I'm going tomorrow probably. You know, we need it all.
Yeah.
We need it all.
I so agree. And to to kind of add to what you were saying, particularly about the power of words to create empathy, I would add to that the power of words to create safe spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that my resistance in the last few months hasn't looked the way I thought it would look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am usually the first person with a sign in the street, you know, and that's very valuable, and I'm so glad that that's happening. But as it turns out, after having brought this book out, having the election have happened right after this book came out, my resistance has actually looked very different in the sense that I have, like I said, I've been getting really flooded with emails kind of every day from women who have read the book and from men who have read the book,
mm-hmm.
and who know women who need the book, or
mm-hmm.
you know, or whatever it is, and from women who are constantly asking questions like, so what can I do to meet women like this in my city,
mm-hmm.
or like, you know, what can, like, women who are like creating virtual online book groups to talk about the book, you know, like things like that. That has really been to like people who are like thinking about creating their own anthologies and like want to talk about like what, you know, what they can do that. And more than anything, people who just like came to the anthology and realized that they weren't alone. And you know, I think that like holding that space for people who are looking for that space,
mm-hmm.
is maybe my role right now.
Yeah.
And I think that has been a real privilege to be able to open that space for people who maybe have never had it. You were talking about being in California as well. I'm from New York, but I just recently started teaching creative writing at Vanderbilt University, so I now live in Nashville.
You went to Vanderbilt. We'll talk. So
I now live in Nashville, and this past fall was my first semester at Vanderbilt, and I was still sort of like, I'm like such a New Yorker, and I'm like trying to figure out Nashville, and I'm trying to figure out Tennessee, and I'm trying to figure out voting in the South, and like, you know, like all of this stuff. And like, but the day after the election, I had 17 kids in my office when I came in that morning, and it was because they were looking for a space,
mm-hmm.
and some of them had read the book, and some of them were in my class, and they felt like maybe this was a space, my office was maybe a space where they could come that morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for me, that is so much the work of literature, and I mean, of course, the work of physically being there and,
mm-hmm.
and being a person available in those moments, but really that was a result of the sort of literature that I am invested in producing. And I think, you know, there were kids that day who revealed to me for the first time that they're undocumented and they're terrified of like what's going to happen to them on this campus or whatever. And like, you know, in a moment where I was feeling so like, I'm not in New York, I'm this brown woman in Tennessee, like the book has just come out, what am I doing? You know, like in that moment, the emails that I got, the kids who came to my office, and the interactions that I was able to have with them, I'm not, like, I'm genuinely talking about not me being a resource for them, but them being a resource for me. Like, me being able to talk to those kids on that campus and feel like there are students here who want to have this conversation, and I want to have this conversation with them. And, you know, that holding open all of those spaces because literature exists, because this literature exists, that, I think, has been the biggest part of my resistance, and I feel like that is entirely because of words.
That is beautiful, and that is so true, because it's to bring people together,
yeah.
to have that safe space,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Now I'd like to open it up for questions from you guys, if you have any. We have about 10, 15 minutes. Yes, please.
What are some of the publishing trends today, in general?
Publishing trends?
Anything jumps out at you?
That's a very broad question, I think.
It's a broad, well, I'm sure it's regional, because I live in LA, and so the LA Times, there's actually tons of literary stuff happening in LA. But, you know, memoir is always, you know, very solid and pretty diverse coverage in the LA Times. Not always, but there's usually some diversity there in terms of which authors are getting reviewed. And I don't know if there's any, you know, there's small press trends and there's commercial trends. I don't know. I mean, look at the bestseller list. I mean, that's sort of, you know, that's kind of what's trending.
I don't know.
I think you said earlier that publishers were looking for the newest Macmillan. So what are they doing today?
I don't know who the newest Terry McMillan is.
I
know, but I don't know what's selling. I am not in.
I wonder, and this is from not from the point of view of a publisher, but from the point of view of a reader. I wonder if specifically in fiction, one of the things that I've been noticing is that, like, sort of voicey fiction has become more sort of like, or just more in vogue than maybe like sort of third person perfect tense fiction was for a long time. And you know, I've been sort of thinking about that too, because in the sense that, like, you know, in some ways, giving a character that we've never really heard from before a really specific voice is so powerful. And in other ways, it can be kind of condescending. And so, you know, for me at least, writing fiction, thinking about fiction, reading fiction, there is a balance between all of those things and creating a voice of a character.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I just don't know what's.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I mean, I'm in poetry, so it's maybe a little different, but I have noticed that there's less of a slant towards stuff that's sort of obtuse and experimental right now. There's more of a slant towards people wanting to tell each other stories in a sort of like interesting or more literal way, or playing with the sort of like literal form of storytelling. And maybe that goes to speak towards what you were saying before about how, you know, storytelling in this moment is actually particularly powerful. That's kind of what I've been seeing. But, you know, it's also, I live in the Bay Area, so that's also a thing there. Any other questions?
Yes,
please.
The gentleman back there.
I'm a fundraiser for an independent press, and on our front list this season, we have some amazing books of diverse authors, you know, in all sorts of ways, queer poets, feminist poets, poets of color, and I really want to highlight some messaging around that, but it's a bit of a different direction from what we've done in the past, and I'd love your advice on how to do it in a way that's not tokenism, that doesn't come across as a ploy, but is really honest to the books.
Are you talking about like publicity for those poets that are?
Well, I'm specifically charged with like fundraising messaging, but it will carry over into our marketing messaging as well.
I see.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Well, I think involving the author,
yeah,
if possible,
yeah,
in generating sort of how the book or project is framed, you know, and sort of what their intentions are, and sort of. And then I do development as well. So, and then, you know, trying to align that with your mission, elements of your mission. Like, if you're committed to dangerous fiction or something, like, well, this is how that fits into that mission. You know, but I would definitely involve, especially if it's a new territory, try to involve the author, because, you know, they have good ideas sometimes. And they know their community, or they may have, you know, I know people do author questionnaires, like, do you have any connections anywhere that, you know, can help promote it? But I think just involve the author and the editor, maybe have a three-way conversation and just see where that leads. I mean, see what kind of language that generates. But I think it's, you know, I once wrote a grant proposal that had a whole new project in it, and of course I and my ED, we didn't consult the program director about it at all, and then a year later he had to implement this program that he had nothing to do designing. So that's not good. So try to involve the people you're writing about or fundraising for.
Yeah. That's perfect.
So I run a small lit pub, and we've been pretty fortunate in the amount of diversity we've had. We're not part of VITA, but we do internal counts, and we 70 to 80% female, You know, like 30 to 40% anybody who doesn't look just like me. That works out pretty well. That being said, we started with the goal of having higher counts than what the averages were, which isn't hard to do as far as having diverse voices. But we're having difficulty reaching into those communities and being trusted as people who want to be shepherds of their voice and of their diversity and just want to open it up to more people. So I'm curious if you have any advice on how to do that without being a jerk.
How many people of color are on your editorial board?
Yeah. We have 0 people of color.
That's
why.
We
have 4 people who are LGBT. We have 1 person who is Asian. That's it.
Well, then you don't have 0 people of color.
Well, but I mean, we don't.
Exactly your point. A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's really just about having the support there to really encourage the community to know that, you know, I mean, who was I looking for when I was looking for editors who might be interested in reviewing the work or in interviewing me or in like thinking about like, you know, putting a spotlight on this book? I was obviously looking for editors who maybe not always just were of color themselves, but certainly editors who had like put an emphasis on works of color before. And so, I think that if you have authors who are in communities of color, if you've already published a couple of people who are in communities of color, maybe ask them to sort of do some outreach for you. Not that I'm telling you to like put all of your issues on the people of color in your life, but just the idea that like that can do a lot, right? Like even just like asking the authors of color who you've published to maybe like put their own work on some listservs of people of color who are looking to get published and stuff like that. Those listservs and those Facebook groups and those whatever they exist. And so, you know, asking the people of color who are already associated with your publication to reach out to those communities is probably the easiest way to do it.
And that would, my concern with doing that, and that's obviously
great, yeah.
My concern with doing that is that it seems like I'm using those people.
Right. So I mean I think it's all in about the way you phrase that first interaction, right? So you don't want to approach that interaction being like, you know, please help me out with this, but by maybe saying like, you know, this is something we're really working towards. I'm really trying to like put more of an emphasis on this. Do you have ideas for like how we might do that, or if and if you're not interested in thinking through that with me, that's totally fine. You know, how you phrase that first interaction matters, I guess.
You could ask them to co-curate a section.
Right.
Find 3 poets you really love.
Right.
And write a little note about them or something. I mean, like, make it a partnership.
Yeah.
You know, like, let's work together to find some new voices, and maybe you can guest curate something or an event or a section of the magazine.
But that's amazing, though. Congratulations on your numbers. That's a big deal.
Yeah, thank you. We're
super fortunate where we're out of Lancaster, and it's not a terribly diverse place. We have Amish.
What's the name of your publication?
Third Point Press.
Okay, well, we'll think about it. Yeah. Like, you know?
Yeah, send us an email.
Yeah.
Sure. Calling people. I have
questions?
Copies of Bloom up here if people want to take some copies. Free copies.
I think we can do one more question.
So I'm like a literary citizen. I like reading. How can I support books written by people of color or diverse books? Like, I know book reviews are one way, but coming from an MFA, we didn't really have a class on book reviews. So I tried it once and I gave up because it just seemed really complicated. So what can I do, or what can I tell my other friends who are also readers or writers? What can we do to help?
So I know this sounds silly, but like Amazon reviews really help. I know it doesn't sound like something that might really help, but they really do. Like giving a book a 5-star review on Amazon, or like writing why you thought it was good, that really helps. Obviously, book reviews really, really help. And the thing that I've learned about book reviews is that they don't have to be like thorough critical works of literary criticism. Like that, I think that's what I used to think book reviews are, and that is like super daunting, and I'm just like, there's a reason why I didn't get a PhD in English, and this is it. You know, like, that's, you know, and so that, It doesn't have to be that, though. It can. This is why I really love the interview format too. Like, anytime I have a friend who has a book come out, I offer to do an interview with them for any publication that will take it, because it's really just me having a chat with my friend, recording it, and then writing it down, you know, about the book. And so that is a super easy. It doesn't take a huge amount of time. Like, but it's a great way to like get information out about the book. Yeah, and just like for me, at least for Good Girls, social media has played a really big role in just the numbers of people who know about it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know how many people are reading it. I know that a number of people are buying it. That's all amazing. But what I do know is that there are very few South Asian American women I come across now who don't know about the book.
That's
and that is remarkable, right? And that's because, it's really because of social media. So having your friends just like, you know, be on social media about the book, I think can be like really, really big.
Two suggestions. Have them go to their bookstore, and if the bookstore has book groups, make a suggestion of that book to the book group. Say, because they probably, like, they don't know which books to pick for the book group.
Yeah.
But if you really love a book, you could offer to lead a discussion at the bookstore about that. And also go to libraries and ask the library if they have it, and make a request for that, even if you already have the book. Because libraries have thousands of books to buy. They don't know what to buy sometimes. But if you can show interest in a certain author or a certain kind of book, then maybe the library will buy it, which means it's there forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm going to just say as a professional, like things like Amazon reviews, you know, requesting copies from your library, all of these things are not just requests that you make to, you know, institutions and corporations. Because they are institutions and corporations, they actually go into what we call the data feed, which I know sounds... I mean, it's all a little murky to me, too. But essentially what it means is that it goes into a system which then informs all of the other corporations and institutions that there is more demand for this book. And when there is more demand, then, you know, places like Amazon, Baker & Taylor, Barnes & Noble, the sort of, like, places that rely more on data than they do on personal recommendation, like your local bookstore, will, in fact, order more of these books, which is very important for sort of overall sales. The library requests, they really pay attention to those too, and fewer people are sort of like going up to their librarian and being like, why don't you have this book?
Yeah.
That's something that we try to encourage as much as possible as a distributor, actually. People call us and say, why didn't Amazon order my book or reorder my book? I say, go to your local librarian and say, I want this book.
Yeah.
Amazon gets that data. They'll then order the book. It's sort of all interconnected in this way.
Scary.
So, you know, these little things really help. Yeah, it's terrifying. But yeah, on that terrifying note, I guess thank you so much to you guys for sharing your stories. And, you know, thank you to you guys for participating.
Finding the room.